For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. This is Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and the guest today is Rhonda Murray. I'm really looking forward to this interview. As everybody knows, my wife is a Harvard Business School graduate, and she's taught me so much about negotiating, but I'm sure I'm going to learn some more from Rhonda. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Don. I appreciate you inviting me to be on your show.
Well, as we do with our guests, Rhonda, tell us a little bit about your past, a little bit about your company, and a website that our audience can go to, and we'll take off from there.
Sounds great. Well, just to give you a little bit about my background, I'm a marketer by trade, so I spent probably a good 15 years working in the golf industry. And during that time, I worked for some pretty high-profile brands ranging from Nike Golf to the PGA to the PGA of America, and just really got to do some great work helping those brands launch new initiatives and programming and just finding ways to get more people into the game. And one of the areas that I had a strong concentration with was that of bringing women into the game. So as you know, golf has been for the history of the game, really a male-dominated game. So some of the efforts that I worked on were designed to help bring women out to the golf course. So it was really at that time that I found my passion. You know how you always hear that you have to find your passion. Well, my passion was helping women get into golf at the time, but now I help women really break through some of the traditional barriers that have held us back. So whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in relationships, whether it's getting out onto the golf course, I help women really find their voices and develop that self-confidence that helps them realize that, hey, I'm just as worthy as the guy sitting next to me to go out and do these different activities that have been male-dominated. So in terms of my organization, the name of my organization is Elevate for Her. And what we do with that particular company is, again, we do development programs, training programs, one-to-one coaching to help women in areas that historically we've been a bit weaker. And one of those areas is negotiation. There's a statistic that's in Forbes, which says that women initiate negotiations four times less frequently than our male counterparts. So when you really stop and think about that statistic, in and of itself, it makes sense, or you can understand why women are behind men in many, many different arenas. So whether it's the pay disparity or whether it's the number of women that lead Fortune 500 organizations or the number of women that sit on corporate boards, if we're not taking ownership of what we want or what we think we deserve by asking, hey, this is what I want, then we'll always have the disparity that we see in our society today.
And your website?
Our website is elevateforher.com. And on the website, you'll find information on the different programs that we offer. So again, we do everything from negotiation training, leadership training, personal branding. We even have some programs for improv, which is helps women improve communication skills in the workplace. So it's www.elevateforher.com, and you could find, in addition to information on our programs, there's also some free resources there as well.
Well, you know, this is radio, so you're going to have to spell it out.
Sure. It's www.elevate, ELEVATE4FORHER.com.
Well, now that we've got all of that out of the way, Rhonda, let me ask you the first question. What are some of the things that affect women, in your experience, that they should identify? Let's start with work.
Sure. Well, the primary thing is just having the self-confidence and that belief that, yes, I am worthy of securing this role or asking for the raise or asking for that plum project. We just don't have the confidence quite often that we need to be competitive in the workplace. So I'll give you an example. We conducted a training, negotiation training program in downtown LA, and actually it was a group of women who work in the entertainment industry, and as such they were their own bosses, right? So they would have to negotiate on their own behalf what type of rates and what kind of work conditions and all of those parameters. And many of the women in the training were really candid and shared the fact that, hey, if I increase my rate, they might not give me the job, and they might give the job to someone else. I'm not comfortable increasing my rates, or I'm not comfortable asking for better terms for my agreement. And we heard this on an ongoing, consistent basis because they didn't want to lose that work. And as a result, many of them had been working with the same pay rate for 10, 15 years. So they really weren't able to grow their business. They weren't able to grow professionally, and they were stagnant. And anytime you become stagnant, it's not a good scenario, you know, in terms of how you feel about yourself. And again, it came back to providing them with the self-confidence and just helping them understand that, yes, you are worthy. Here's the list of your accomplishments. So we had several different success stories that resulted from that particular training session, because we were able to not only provide the women with really tangible, practical negotiation skills, but we gave them, we help empower them and help build up their confidence so that they could go in and implement those negotiation strategies, and then in the end increase their pay rate. So we've seen the training in action. We know that it works, and we know that many women find themselves in this situation, but we really encourage them, whether they take one of our programs or they start reading one of the many great books out there on negotiation strategies. You've got to start somewhere and identifying, okay, this is what this is where I want to get, and here are the steps that I need to take to get there.
Well, but Rhonda, let's stop 1 minute. I've heard that as well, but in that highly competitive world of entertainment, if they do raise the price, aren't they at risk to losing their gig?
Well, yeah, that's a hard, cold reality of that, right? But one situation in particular, there was a woman who worked on several really high-profile blockbusters. So everything from Black Panther to Star Trek to Star Wars. She had been hired to work on these feature films, and she had a really good relationship with the director, who would vouch for the quality of her work. Would vouch for her reputation, and he wanted her on that particular feature. So what we helped her realize is, hey, you've got to leverage all these benefits that you have going for you, and you need to take advantage of the past history of work and your accomplishments. And again, that's all part of the strategic part of negotiations, but it starts with us showing her, hey, here's your value. And sometimes that it really takes an outsider or someone, a third party, that to take a look at what you've done. I think sometimes we overlook some of our accomplishments and some of the things that we've been able to achieve over the course of our career. But when someone else looks at it and really brings it to your attention, a lot of times, at least from the perspective of the women that we've worked with, they're like, yeah, you're right, I have done all these things, and I kind of forgot about that. So we help identify or just highlight the things that they really should be leveraging when in a negotiating situation.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I understand that. You always have that fear of if you price yourself too high, you'll price yourself out of the game.
Right. But to that point also is, and again, this is another one of our strategies, you really have to do your research. You know, you have to know what the market conditions are. You need to know what other individuals in a like situation, or how much they're making, or what kind of deal points they're able to secure. And this woman in particular that I'm talking about, she did do just that, and she found that in different markets and in different projects, she was vastly underpaid. So by her doing some of the legwork and realizing, hey, you know what, I haven't been charging enough for however many years, but it wasn't until she put in the time, did the work, and put forth the effort, did she realize, there is some opportunity for me to go and increase my rates. Here's why I'm increasing my rates, and then get the deal points that she was looking to secure.
Well, you know you're right about that, but let me ask you the other question that came up, came up in a recent Wall Street Journal article where it was indicated that a woman was being discriminated against simply because she was not the friend of the C-level executives, but was a critical component in the company. But they had kept her out of the bonus pool. How does someone handle that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that that situation to me sounds like there's some what we call would fall into our diversity and inclusion, and that is one of the hottest areas of discussion in business today. And you'll see. I was just reading an article about the increase, I think it was on CNN.com, the increase in the number of organizations that are hiring diversity and inclusion officers so that you don't have situations where it comes to light that Susie or Ellen was not included in the bonus pool. I think some of that has come to light, whether it's Google had issues like that. A lot of organizations are trying to be proactive and really taking a look internally to finding out, okay, do we have parity with our pay, whether it's from a male-female vantage point. And when they're realizing, hey, we have some issues here, they're putting in mechanisms so that they can right those wrongs. And again, a lot of that is something that is really under scrutiny right now with all of the Me Too movements and all of the what I call the white hot spotlight on all things women. I mean, right now is really a good time for women to take a look at their pay and if they feel like, hey, I deserve a raise or my raise wasn't what they thought it should be, I would definitely have some discussions with either HR or her direct superiors to see what could be done to increase those. Because, you know, it's probably a fact, a well-known fact, that in many, many organizations, women are just underpaid. I think there's study after study that proves that. But it's up to women to, again, do their research, collect the information that's needed, and most importantly, ask. You know, ask the right person who can make a decision to help identify what could be done to bring that pay level to more of a parity scenario.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I attended an investor program 2 weeks ago, and there were 48 people that appeared in teams of three or four, and 47 of them were male, and one was female.
Wow. Those are
and
not good numbers.
And I pointed that out to the host, and it was a he. He admitted, said, it's just the way of things. And these were like top firms, you know, that were looking for cash, but were really weaned as some of the best in New York.
Wow.
What do you say to that?
What do I say to that? Well, first off, I think there's, I think today a lot of men are feeling like, hey, I'm getting beat up about this. But and we really shouldn't take that approach. I think the approach should be is, hey, you know, let's take a look around the room. And quite often, and it's just natural, quite often you associate with people that look like you or from similar backgrounds. I mean, it is what it is. I think there's that old saying of birds of a feather. So in a situation like that, I think the number one thing is creating awareness. I mean, and you pointed it out, saying, hey, there's only one female here in a group of men. So one is creating awareness and identifying, okay, something's not right here, where the male-female divide is approximately 50-50, right? But we only have one female in the room. But from there, identifying, okay, where are there opportunities to bring more women to the table? And the great thing that I've noticed over the last probably year, and I've been in business for 20-plus years, so when I first started out, and again, I worked in the golf industry. When I first started out, I was typically the only female in the room. And if there was another female, quite often it became an adversarial situation because you're each trying to claw your way and jockey for position within that organization because you knew that, hey, it's not fertile fields up at the leadership role for women. That's just the reality. But I think in today's society, I see a lot more collaboration amongst women. I see a lot more unifying amongst women. And A, that's a beautiful thing. And then B, it just helps when there's strength in numbers. I belong to a couple different organizations where it's just a collection of women. And quite often it's, hey, do you know a good coach, or do you know an attorney that does this type of work? And it's just sharing resources and developing some relationships. And those types of organizations are sprouting up in various aspects of business, which I think for organizations looking to increase their diversity and inclusion numbers, they're easier to find. So again, years ago, the common sentiment was, hey, we just don't know where to find really strong professional women. Well, now they're everywhere. All you have to do is Google, and you'll find, you know, just several organizations that are designed for women who are looking to, you know, work their way up the corporate ladder. So I think that's that no longer is going to be able to be something that is believable, because there's an incredible number of really talented women. The other flip side of that,
Rhonda, before you go further, let me tell our audience we're talking with Rhonda Murray. Rhonda, your website for people?
Sure, it's elevateforher.com.
Can you spell it out for our audience again?
Sure, elevate is ELEVATE for FOR, her, HER.com.
Okay, now we can continue, but I wanted to make sure our audience knew who were listening to this really fascinating conversation.
No, and I appreciate it. But where I was going, Dawn, is that in terms of creating a more diverse workplace, it's really a fascinating study, and I really encourage your listeners to do some research. But there's numerous studies that have come out over the last few years that show on a repeated basis that organizations that have a diverse leadership group or more diversity within their organizations just perform better. I mean, so you'll read things such as a 15% increase in bottom line performance. You'll read things about organizations being much more innovative. So I think there's obviously something to be said by adding different perspectives to your organizations, because obviously you're selling products to a very diverse world. I mean, quite often you're selling on a global basis. So why wouldn't you want those different types of perspectives within your organizations? Because what's one of the biggest challenges that we have in small business is trying to figure out, what does my customer or my potential customer want? So if we could have those different slices of the population within your organization, intuitively you would deduct that, hey, I'm going to do better because I'm not looking at this from just one vantage point. I'm looking at it from various perspectives. And again, we could probably go back to when we're kids and you learn, you know, teamwork is better than just one person. So I think when you kind of expound on that and expand that viewpoint, you know, it makes sense.
Well, let me toss something out at you. Interesting you brought that out. We had another guest on the program last week who said one of the reasons these companies succeed is that women tend to have a better capacity to raise not objections so much as questions, which in such a way as to enable the other senior members to examine things in a different way than they would if they were just an all-male group. What
exactly
do you think about that?
I totally agree with it. I mean, I think you could even bring that down to a really base level when you look at a relationship between a married couple, let's say. I know in my situation, there's certain male qualities and ways of thinking that my husband thinks, but it works so nicely against the way that I think. So it just becomes very complementary. But in the workplace, yeah, totally. I see that, where typically some of the typical male traits are assertiveness, and that can be counteracted by a woman's aversion to risk. So some of those traits on each side, they counterbalance each other. To whereas if you only have one perspective, that's all you have. You have one perspective. Obviously it makes a lot more sense if you could look at whether it's a new product or your pricing or whatever business situation you're looking at, if you could look at it from a much more holistic or comprehensive vantage point, then your odds are much better for winning.
Well, let me ask you a question, Rhonda. It's always to me the 60. Do you think women are more able to take more risks than men?
I think I think some of this is learned too, right? So just because we were put on the earth with a certain number of traits or a certain way of looking at the world doesn't mean that it can't be modified or that it can't be tweaked. So, you know, in my case, I grew up as a incredibly shy and passive girl. That's just who I am, by virtue of my makeup. However, as I matured and got into business and started having these big dreams and big goals, I had to let go of that side of who I am. And I've become much more assertive and, dare I say, aggressive, because I know, hey, this is my end game. And if I want to get there, these are the steps I need to take. So in many ways, to be quite honest, I've modified a lot of my traits to be a little more male-leaning, because that works for me, and I've had much more success. And again, it might be the however many years I spent in conference rooms and boardrooms working alongside of men, that some of those things that worked for them, I picked up and made them my own. Some of those traits I, you know, rely on daily. And going back to my original comment is that women just are often afraid to ask for what they want. I'm not one of those women. So it's taking what you know or what you identify as being positive traits in business and figuring out, okay, how do I develop those?
Unfortunately, Rhonda, we've reached the end of our time together. Your website, one last time for our audience?
Sure, I'd love that. It's www.elevateforher, and I'll spell it E-L-E-V-A-T-E for F-O-R, her, H-E-R. com.
Well, thank you so much for a very illuminating time together. And a link to that website will be on Small Business Digest tonight. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thanks so much. Enjoyed the invite. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
One, the Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone. And my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes, hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. We recall his mother, Tony Soprano's mother, ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. This is Small Business Digest. My name is Donald Mazzella, and Kyle M.K. is our guest today. He's here to talk about a subject that's dear to my heart, toxic bosses. I will tell you, I left big corporations just because of them, but I'll let Kyle talk more about it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kyle, first tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about what you're doing now, and whatever else. Thank you.
Yeah, I started my career at Apple a little more than 10 years ago, and that's kind of where I fell in love with the idea of customer experience and really great employee engagement. And ever since then, I've been just obsessed with gathering as much information from all of the big players and a bunch of different industries on how they gain loyalty from customers and from employees, and how some brands succeed over others, even though they might make the same product. So my entire career has been dedicated to solving this question.
Mm-hmm. And what's your current company?
Right now, I'm consulting. I have a consulting business called The Heart Company, and we just go from business to business to help companies become more people-focused, so that way they can gain more, have better customer experiences or better cultures.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as it happened just last night, I was talking with someone who was involved in the creation of the Stephen Jobs autobiography, and they indicated to me that he was a very toxic boss, yet he elicited great loyalty. I don't know if your time with that Apple overlapped with his.
It did, although I didn't work under him directly. But yeah, I was there when he was CEO, and and through the transition over to Tim Cook. But Steve was more of a, you know, was known to be a toxic boss back in the 70s and 80s when he came back to Apple in the late 90s. His temperament kind of became a little bit more calm. He had a much easier way of expressing his vision and his emotions than he did when he was younger.
Well, before we go further, do you have a book or something that our audience can latch on to?
Yeah, I actually just published one a couple months ago. It's called The Economics of Emotion, and it's available on Amazon and on the Apple Bookstore.
Okay. Now, having said that, give us an idea of what you consider a toxic boss, one that is detrimental, and a toxic boss that, in effect, creates a positive growth, corporate growth.
Sure. A toxic boss is someone who kind of makes everyone around them miserable. they either bring them down, bring down their team by inducing a lot of fear, or yelling at them, or never giving them any positive reinforcement. These are people who take pride in having no emotion and being able to make the tough decisions. But they're also the people that no one wants to work with. And so you can consider a toxic boss kind of like a cancer. Like if you see a toxic boss moving up in the company, everybody else will see that, and they'll think that those are the types of qualities they will need to employ in order to, you know, move ahead. And so other people will start to mimic that, and it just becomes worse. And you can have a really, really bad culture all of a sudden just because of one person. And this happened with Uber, when Uber's former CEO, Travis Kalanick, was in charge. He was not the best people person. And although he led a company, you know, to be a global brand, the culture on the inside was just horrible. And I was there, actually, for 3 months, and it was just not good. Luckily the board of directors kind of realized that he was kind of the, you know, patient zero, if you will, and kind of cut him out, as well as some of his, leaders that he hired, who also were very toxic to the brand. And then they came in and they hired a new CEO, and that new CEO hired some of his new leaders, and now the culture is a lot better. So that's an example of a toxic leader who got a company to a certain point, but it definitely was not going to get it any further. And so hopefully it's a lesson that he's learned, for any future company he decides to start.
We're talking with Kyle M.K. He's got a fascinating book. Kyle, the name of the book again?
It's The Economics of Emotion.
Okay. How did you come up with that title?
Well, it came from an observation that I made while actually I was at Apple, that people traded emotion as if it were currency. And obviously we don't use a smile to buy a computer or anything like that, but that we use emotion to get what we want out of others, to motivate them to stop or continue doing what they're doing. And knowing very little about economics, I decided that I was going to read a lot about it. And, you know, obviously economics doesn't just deal with finances. It's a wider discipline of, you know, how resources are moved and consumed and produced. And in this case, if you consider emotion as a currency, you can very clearly see how emotion is moved and consumed and produced by people and transferred, you know, and traded. So the book is kind of talks about that, and then it goes a little bit deeper and shows how if you understand the economics of emotion, then you can use that information to build a more people-centric business.
Hmm. Well, you know, when I read about your book, what came to mind is an old joke. Why does a mother stay in the hospital 3 days after giving birth? And the answer is to learn how to instill guilt in their children. It just popped out at me because what you said hit home in so many levels. That's one of the reasons you're on the program. But we're a program for a small business. How does your idea apply to small business, in your view?
Very easily, actually. I work with small businesses all the time, and it's much easier to incorporate emotion into a small business than it is a large business, at least much quicker. And so with small businesses, it's important to remember that, like, small does not mean that people can't love it. And especially if you're working within a local neighborhood and you're trying to gain some brand recognition and have some loyal customers, you really have to decide, like, how do you want your neighborhood to feel when they see your sign or your logo around town? And my guess is that most small businesses, if not all small businesses, want customers to feel excited to see their brand or happy or even relaxed if it's like a spa or something. So everything that you do should be focused around, removing negative emotions and addressing the positive ones.
Well, you're talking internally as well as externally, am I correct?
Very much so. Yeah, this definitely works for employees as well as it does with for customers.
Well, could we concentrate a little bit on that for the moment and just say what are some of the ways you can alter and make this a positive environment in your view?
Well, yeah, if we were to start from the beginning of an employee's, experience, it's in their, search for a job, right? And for small businesses, it's very difficult to have a really well thought out onboarding experience because you're not taking the time to sit down and create training or have a series of interviews. You're really you're on the go. You probably need someone now. But you should remember that if you feel rushed, then you're not going to be able to get the most out of them, and you might end up hiring someone that's not good for your business, and you just wasted money on them and time. And what you really want is you want to attract the best people. So the number one thing that I would recommend when, trying to find employees is how do you want, who are you trying to attract here? Are you trying to attract someone who is professional and carries himself with a lot of confidence? Do you want someone who's a little bit more laid back and relaxed? Do you want someone who's fun loving and can have casual conversation with anybody? Depending on who you're trying to attract, that's the type of job description that you should be putting out. And that's how your interview should be carried. And when you invite them to join the company, their first day should mimic how you want them to treat others. So if you want them to be fun-loving and have casual conversations with everybody that walks in, well, the first thing you should do is introduce them to as many people as you can and see how they fare. It's once you have this intense focus on the types of people that you want, you'll start to attract those people And then once they're there, it's important to keep them engaged. If you just say, here's your job, I'll see you when I see you, it's very difficult to keep someone motivated. But if you say, here's your purpose, you know, at this company, we want to make people happy, or we want to inspire joy. So here are the resources that we have for you to achieve that. That's how you get someone to come back every day wanting to work as hard as they can and inspire them to stick around for a long time.
Well, let me ask you a different question on the same point. We tend to hire in our own image, jocks, hiring jocks, et cetera. How do you get people to understand that they need to look at other traits?
Well, it's kind of, if you were to like use the metaphor of colors, if purple only hired purple and red only hired red and green only hired green, that's a very boring color palette, right?
Right.
There's no way that you'll get new ideas or new perspectives or different perspectives. Everyone will have the same personality, which often clashes. It's not the best thing. You want as much diversity and intellect and thought process as possible, and that comes from hiring people from different types of backgrounds. And ethnicities, of course, and anything that you can get any amount of diversity you can bring in, I strongly recommend it because it provides a more colorful company.
I agree with you. As you said it, I was thinking back to the time I staffed, but the funny part is I've had occasion in the last couple of weeks to see over 35 different companies, smaller startup companies, food companies, et cetera, for my other program. And what struck me, and again, this came up last night, was the fact that the companies were amazingly uniform. I attended a conference where companies pitched to credit investors, and of the 48 young people on the program, 47 of them were males between 25 and 30, and only
wow.
One woman. None of them were black or Hispanic. It was an amazing. I've mentioned it now three or four times in recent programs, and I sat there and I talked to the person who put it together, and they said, yes, that's what we're running into. This was a New York City startup grouping, and it just blew my mind. But then in other places, I've seen the same thing. In the case, ironically, the food, they were mostly women and almost no men. But again, it's the industry. And I'm glad you're on this program because I think you're bringing some needed perspective to this. Would you care to comment on that?
I think that people see someone that looks like them do a thing, and that inspires them to do the same thing. A lot of people are afraid of trying something new, so unless there's a precedent, it's very difficult to inspire someone to put themselves outside of their comfort zone. And so when you have a bunch of white males, like in the show, the HBO show Silicon Valley, the CEOs of the companies and the main character is like a white male between the ages of like 25 and 35. and his co-founder, same thing. And it's and so people who fit that description will see that and be like, oh, I can do that too. But you have women of color who don't see any representation whatsoever, and you know, whether consciously or subconsciously, it deters them. They're like, you know, there's, I don't see someone else like me doing that, so I probably can't do that. And it, you know, this is why, like, programs like Women Who Can Code and all of that, and like any sort of program that like takes as much diversity in as possible to industries that are normally white males, I find those to be some of the like the best and programs with the hardest workers in the industry.
We're talking Kyle MK. He's got a new book. Again, the title, Kyle, and where people can get it.
They can get it on Amazon, both an ebook as well as a physical copy, and then they can also grab ebooks on Apple's bookstore.
And the title again?
It's The Economics of Emotion.
I love that title. I love. Now let's go further. You brought up so many good points. Our audience, again, is small. 59% of our audience are presidents and or owners. What are the two or three things you tell a leader when you come into their company? Wait a second. I'm going to turn it around. What do you ask them first, and then what do you usually tell them?
My first question is, how do you want to make people feel? And the second question is, how do you think you actually make people feel? And then, one of the things that I, tell them is that, I guess the third question is, why does your business exist? And if they don't have answers, or they only have answers to a couple of those, that's the first thing that we work on. But I usually tell them that, like, if your purpose, if the behind your company is not to help others or enrich their lives, then what is the point of the business? And you can enrich lives in many ways. You can have a hunting lodge. You can have a spa. You can have a mini golf course. All sorts of different small businesses can enrich lives in different ways. But if you're not there to enrich a life or enrich the neighborhood, then why does your business exist? And it really gets them thinking. And in some cases, small businesses will kind of change their approach because they have a really great product, but they didn't really consider like how it actually affects people. And they immediately see a change and how customers respond to their marketing campaigns or any sort of events that they post on Facebook.
That's really good. Would you like to elaborate a little further on it? Because I'm finding it fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that, like, if you're not people-focused, I mean, every business that exists is made up of people, right? And most businesses that exist are there to serve people. And it's funny to me that with enterprises that are like the engine is people, no one really puts that much energy into people. They put it into product. They put it into finding ways to have a better process, and you know, if it's a real estate company, they're looking at different places. But no one's focused on people. And the thing is that the folks who are focused on people, these are the Southwest Airlines of the world, the Disneys, the Starbucks, the Apples, the Ritz-Carlton's, all of these huge companies, they all started as small businesses, and they became these monoliths because they focused on people. They were so intensely focused on enriching the lives of people. So so if a small business wants, even if you don't want to grow and you just want to stay one location or even an online store, that's totally fine. But the only way that you're going to be able to continue doing that is if you can, if you put more focus on people than you do on your product.
Well, let me jump in here and ask you, you bring up an interesting one, Disney. I'm old enough to have been in Disneyland the third year that it opened, the original. Yes, and you're right about that. Yeah, and it's morphed into a multi-billion dollar that just closed a $70 billion acquisition. And but going to the core amusement park, it seems to me that that amusement park has lost its way a little bit, $150 a day tickets and things like that. You think that they have still maintained their focus on the individual?
Absolutely. I can say so with the utmost confidence. Now, obviously, the park tickets are more expensive. And, you know, half of that, I'm sure, is to deter huge crowds, right? Because if they were inexpensive, then you wouldn't be able to enjoy the park if you went. Nobody would. And another part is that, like, they continue to innovate how they manage someone's emotions throughout their experience at Disney. And so if there was no innovation and the park hadn't changed since the, you know, 60s or 70s, then I don't think I would have the same answer. But because they continuously put money back into the park to make it a better experience, to have more detail, to have stronger rides, I can very much say that they have probably more of a focus on the guest experience than they've had in the past. But it all starts with, like, Walt, where, you know, he, you know, went to a carnival, I think, with his daughter. And he was just like, I can do this. And that's where the idea of Disneyland came. But when they were building it, he would get on his knees and his hands and knees, and he would try to be at the same height as the children that he was trying to inspire joy out of. And he said, I want to know what the experience is of a 3 or a 4-year-old, someone who is less than 4 feet tall. And so he got on his knees to see what that was like. And a lot of designs changed because of that. And, you know, Six Flags doesn't do that. You don't see the CEO of Six Flags going around on his knees going, you know, trying to figure out what type of experience am I trying to inspire for, you know, young children. And that's why Six Flags has a bunch of parks, but, like, it's not considered the happiest place on earth.
A few more. My only regret is I didn't buy stock at the time.
Yeah.
You know, he bet his fortune. We have just a few minutes left. What would the one thing you'd like to leave our audience with?
I think it was what I was saying before, is that if you're not intensely focused on people, then the controversial statement I say is then why do you exist? And so my biggest piece of advice is put as much energy into people, and what inspires people and what motivates them is their emotions. If you make people happy, they feel comfortable around you and they want to be around you more. If you make them frustrated, though, they do not want to be around you and they will cut you out of their lives. So you want to take away as many negative emotions as possible and inspire as many positive ones as you can.
Well, Kyle, MK, thank you so much for being with us. One last time, your book and your website?
Yeah, it's the book is called The Economics of Emotion, and it's on Amazon as well as Apple Books. And you can find me all over the internet. If you just Google Kyle MK, you can find my website as well as my blog and any sort of social media.
Thank you so much for being with us. A link will be.
Thank you so much, Donald.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.
AM FM 247, the best in talk and music, all day and every day.